I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The common goal is to beat Donald Trump. The questions at this point are how, who, and what is most likely to work to actually kick his butt out of there. Of course, there are a couple of dozen candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. A recent Facebook post said he'd vote for a fire hydrant over Donald Trump. Yeah, there's a lot of that sentiment around. Millions of traditional patriotic Americans agree the damage that is being done to our Republican form of government, the real damage to people's lives, the status of Earth itself, all demand concerted determination and action to oust this clearly deranged wannabe dictator. But what will work? Clearly, the last go-round was a shocking and stunning failure. What must Democrats do to actually achieve the removal of Donald Trump? What candidate and version of the Democratic Party will best connect and inspire the various demographics and regions we really should have won in 2016? Working people, voters in states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan. Does the word socialist frighten them enough to keep them in the Trump column? And what do these swing voters think of when they think of the Democratic Party? What is our identity? I think that's been a big part of the problem. As many reporters can attest, all the action these days is within the Democratic Party. The Republican Party has very effectively become the property of Donald Trump. It is indeed unified. Democrats are divisible into two distinct sectors, the more conservative, cautious, corporate Hillary and DNC New Democrats from the 90s, and the more traditional liberals in the FDR mold. And that is the problem we'll address on today's show. What is happening in Congress with the various organizations within the Democratic Party? What's going to work? What's going to emerge? One of the areas of contention relates to the politics of the House of Representatives. These elections, of course, come every 2 years, and our guest, Owen Higgins, senior editor at Common Dreams, addresses what's going on behind the scenes within the Democratic Party in an article titled, A Network of Alternative Campaign Infrastructure. Progressives dismiss DCCC, DCCC threats on primary challengers. Owen, thanks for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, one of the questions implicit in this discussion is choosing a path forward. The party is certainly at a crossroads. Each side believes the other's way could lead to another disaster like 2016. All agree that must be avoided. So that basically heightens the tension. Let's look at where we are and how we got here. Oh, and looking back at the last presidential election, there were clearly two sides, two factions. We know which side prevailed at the convention, as Hillary became the nominee, who, of course, went on to lose the general election. How might those two wings be defined, do you think, from your research?
Well, I think that your early remark that it was kind of like, you know, New Deal liberalism on one side and maybe the 90s New Democrats on the other side is a, well, I mean, that's a good historical way to look at it. If you wanted to really just strip it down and simplify it, you could just say that there is the left wing of the party, and that's kind of the Sanders, Ocasio-Cortez, Presley, Tlaib, Omar wing. And then there's the center right, which is basically everybody from Pelosi to Schumer to the Clintonites. And the people, and by the way, I mean, these are, and Obama, I mean, these are the people who have had control over the party for decades.
I want to ask a quick question. Are you on speakerphone right now?
I am, yeah.
Oh, could you not do that, please? it's not as good sound. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure. Would you like me to do the answer again?
Yeah. No. Much better. That's fine.
Right.
Yeah, I agree that those are the two sides. And certainly the party apparatus includes many sets of bureaucracy. There's the Democratic National Committee, which is a pretty big bureaucracy and has a lot of money at stake and holding on to their jobs, which they have oversight basically over everything, especially nominating procedure rules. A lesser known entity which you address is the DCCC. Who are they and what is their job?
Yes, the DCCC is a kind of party apparatus. They are in charge of one thing, and that is to get Democrats elected to the House of Representatives. They are an objective, they are a supposed to be an objectively neutral party.
Right.
They pretty much just exist, much like the DNC, just kind of exist to kind of facilitate the way that these elections are run. You know, a good analogy would kind of be that everyone's playing the game, and this person or the DNC is just kind of acting as the person who is enforcing the rules, and just making sure that, but making sure that that the people that are playing win.
And they're supposed to be a neutral arbiter. I ran for Congress myself in 1986, did not get the nomination, but they were neutral then. And there's been a lot of concern about the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee over the years violating its own bylaws. In fact, back in 2006, here in this congressional district in New Hampshire, they had not officially, but quietly backed one candidate. Well, the other candidate beat him in the primary and then became a long-term, terrific member of Congress. But it seems that it's kind of gotten worse, that the DCCC is getting involved in primaries. They're supposed to stay strictly neutral in primaries. Tell us about a decision in March 2019 relative to vendors that are hired by candidates. What are those vendors and what did the DTRIP do regarding that?
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting decision that they made, in that it is one of those things where it's like, technically you could say that they're not getting involved because they're not directly getting involved in each primary, but it's obviously, as I'll explain, they are getting involved. It's kind of like one of those like plausible deniability things. So what they're doing is they are saying that for this next cycle and presumably every cycle beyond that, the DCCC will blacklist any vendors, and that, you know, that means strategy firms, communication firms, analysts, polling, volunteer, you know, get out the vote stuff, like any company or nonprofit that that relies on the Democrats kind of for consulting money, et cetera, you know, in campaigns. So what they're telling all of these vendors is that if you work for a Democrat who is challenging an incumbent in a primary, you will be blacklisted. We will not work with you. And so what that is effectively doing is it is sending the message to these companies that, you know, rely, again, on the Democratic Party to make all their money, that if they support any of these progressive challengers, I mean, because that is, you know, what this is aimed at,
sure,
you know, who are going to be going after incumbents to get them, you know, out of office, that then they will no longer be able to rely on DCCC for money. And in fact, the DCCC will actively make sure that they are not hired for any DCCC affiliated campaigns. And as Ayanna Pressley, Democrat from Massachusetts 1st District,
yes,
who beat incumbent Mike Capuano back in 2018 and then easily won the, I mean, I don't think she was even challenged. There's not much of a point to challenge somebody in the first if from the right. So
no.
She went in, and as she pointed out on Twitter in kind of a lengthy thread, that the decision was explicitly meant to stop people like her and like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who did the similar thing down in New York, that this decision was directly targeted at them and at anybody presuming to do kind of the same thing, to go after these right-wing Democrats, replace them with the progressives, and then, you know, go forward with a Democratic Party that's presumably, in this case, younger, more progressive, more female, and more diverse.
Uh-huh. It amazes me. So many questions you raise there, like, how did the decision get made? And clearly, I mean, it seems pretty obvious on the face of it that it's an incumbent protection scheme. But sometimes I think the party structure, the party regulars, the bureaucracy would really rather lose to Republicans than let anybody, you know, not them win, like Presley, like Ocasio-Cortez. It just amazes me. So do you have any idea how, what kind of a bureaucracy made that decision, you know, to freeze out? And the other part of their question is, blacklist, what does that mean? I mean, if the candidate, and sometimes people wonder, why do they need all that money to run? Yeah, well, polls are expensive, voting lists are expensive, you know, a lot of consultants, advertising, very expensive. So how can they be blacklisted? Does that mean that if this person gets the nomination, then the DCCC, which is allegedly there to elect Democrats to Congress, will not use them, even if, you know, if the candidate has already used them? Long question. Go see if you can unravel that one.
Sure, yeah. So let me start. Let me go back to how the decision was made. So, yes, I don't know how. I don't know who was behind it other than what's been made public, which is that Representative Sherry Bustos, a Democrat from Illinois who is in charge of the DCCC, is the person who's at least owning the decision publicly. As far as, you know, who made the decision within the workings of the party, that's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably it got run by Pelosi and Hoyer, and then I guess that they didn't object to it, but I don't even really feel comfortable saying that because, again,
it's all behind closed
while
doors.
They are party leadership, you know, it's actually not their decision, technically. So I don't know. You know, I would be surprised if they had a problem with it. But again, I don't want to say 100% like what happened there.
Sure.
So as far as we know, it is Sherry Bustos, representative, who also came out, I believe it was last week, in an interview with Politico and said that she had no intention of backing down on this. This was her decision. This is what's, you know, going to happen. She met with Congressional Progressive Caucus members and just basically told them to
pound sand.
Yeah. That's one way to put it. You know, but you know, nothing was going to change. And so, you know, this is a
It's a hard and fast decision, and
yeah, good lines are being drawn, I guess you could say, you know.
really,
but as far as what the blacklist means, you know, I think the way that you explained it is pretty much dead on. I mean, that is what it is. So, if you are, I mean, the Democratic Party functions in some ways, not always, but in some ways, as a massive cash cow for consulting firms.
Yes.
And this is not unique, right?
Oh, for sure.
To the Democratic Party. It's not unique to political parties in Washington. It's just kind of like the way that our governmental system in D.C. works, where all of these consulting firms and across the country, all of these consulting firms, polling firms, et cetera, rely on these parties in order to generate their income, and their business model is basically based off of that. So if, say, you are an analytic firm or some kind of consulting firm and you work with Democrats in the House and in the Senate, but let's say mostly in the House, and this up-and-coming primary challenger who you think has a real chance to knock off this old entrenched Democratic incumbent who is maybe not great, and wants to work with you, and it's this opportunity to really get your name out there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yeah, all of that stuff will happen. But then once that person wins and they start turning to the DCCC for funding as the party, I mean, that's what the DCCC is for, as we already talked about.
Yep.
That at that point, the DCCC will be like, yeah, okay, like we'll give you all this stuff, but this vendor is not going to get any money from us forever. And so what that does is it just really makes it makes the consequence of supporting one of these primary challengers
pretty
awful. And so you wouldn't want to do it.
Wow. Interesting. Boy, talk about Democrat with a small D. Not. My goodness.
Right.
And if you just tuned in, Burt Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a heavy lift. We need everybody. We're speaking with Owen Higgins, senior editor at Common Dreams, who's written about what's going on with the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, kind of shutting out progressives, being real aggressive about that, I must say, because, you know, money is what it's about. So how is the DNC going to enforce this decision, do you think? DCCC, I meant. You know, what can they? There must be pushback from within the Congressional Democratic Caucus, especially since some of the, AOC and Presley, they're rising stars in the party. I mean, they're nationally known now. So they can't be real happy with this.
Yeah, I mean, they're not. Ocasio-Cortez called for progressives to stop all the small dollar donations to DCCC until the thing was kind of settled out. As I said before, Presley put out this, I think it's 7, 8, 9 tweet long, thread on why, this is a bad idea and how her election kind of shows why it's good to have progressive primary challengers. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pushback on this. Again, as I said earlier, Representative Bustos, the Illinois congresswoman who is the head of the DCCC, does not seem interested in backing down or changing or compromising in any way. She did meet with members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, like Representatives Mark Pocan and Ro Khanna, as well as Pramila Jayapal, the Democrat from Washington, who
those are some good progressives,
the lead sponsor of Medicare for All in the House. So, yeah, I mean, she met with them, and she told them to kick sand or, whatever, however you want to put it.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there is pushback on this. It's hard to see where it goes. As far as how they enforce it, I mean, they just, I would assume
they can do their blacklist.
Yeah, they just don't hire them for anything.
Boy, that's incredibly, I mean, having been in politics, there's just so many vendors out there that, they want to win. Their goal is to win. And, they need money. They don't need money. They make a tremendous amount of money. And the presidential campaigns, it's interesting. People don't know about the placing of ads on TV, what money changes hand there. It's a little surprising, quite frankly. Now, what about the allegation that the DCCC is really trying to hoard power? They have some, what about their record? Did they not have proven success? And if they do, why mess with success?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a big question. I don't know. I think that they can certainly point to this election that just passed, the midterms, as success. They took the majority in the House.
Yes.
They would probably, I don't want to get too into the weeds and put words into their, mouth or anything, but I mean, I'm sure that they might make the case that, their losses could have been worse, during Obama presidency during 2016, it's I think that they probably do okay. Their power is really based in their money one kind of would wonder, based on what you said, if maybe now they're seeing that their huge cash advantage over, you know, progressives or any kind of like upsurge in the party, if that cash advantage is maybe not as much as it used to be with the popularity of progressive politics, maybe that's, maybe this is kind of like one of those like Hail Mary pass kind of things where it's like, okay, we're going to do whatever we need to do.
Interesting. And you know, as Bob Dylan once said, money doesn't talk, it swears. You know, it's really powerful. And I, no doubt the new traditional liberals, in my opinion, are doing quite well in terms of making money. And it's interesting, you know, looking at the couple of dozen presidential candidates, how well they're doing is a direct measure of how much money they've made and who it's from. And that's one thing that I think is fascinating, that the DNC and the old Democratic Leadership Council, which was that corporate conservative group, the so-called New Democrats that put Bill Clinton into office and were big supporters of Hillary Clinton, they didn't figure on the small donations. They didn't figure on Bernie's $27 contribution average, you know, through the internet. But now that little bits of money from a few million people can make a huge difference, I would think they'd be starting to think, maybe we ought to do something about that. Because, you know, as I think it was Tip O'Neill who called money the mother's milk of politics, something like that. I mean, you just got to have it. Well, your article introduces us to something that was new to me, quite frankly. Please tell us about the 14 progressive groups which recently announced the launch of the DCCC blacklist.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, after this policy was introduced, as you know, members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus were trying to meet with Representative Bustos and convince her not to use her leadership of the organization, the DCCC, to further this policy. And as, you know, again, Ayanna Pressley and Ocasio-Cortez were both publicly, you know, putting themselves in line, talking about why this was a bad position. So as all of this stuff is going on, there was a group of 14 progressive vendors, consultants, analysts, polling, you know, get out the vote people, who began, you know, making noise on social media about like, okay, well, if that's the way that you want to be, then we'll just kind of start our own party apparatus here, where we'll just have like a, you know, there will just be a collective of vendors who you can choose who don't want to work with the DCCC, and we'll all work together. And that was not an idle threat, because on April 5th, April 4th, they launched DCCC Blacklist, where, you know, it was a collective, it was these 14 groups, and then they said, hey, you know, if you want to join us, just go ahead, sign up for it. And what I think is so interesting about this is that it looks like this move by the DCCC could actually backfire on them in the worst way possible from their perspective.
Nice.
And that if a new party apparatus is built that involves these different companies deciding that they're just going to work independently of the DCCC. Again, we just talked about what the DCCC's power is. It's money and being able to direct money around. Well, if that they don't have that anymore, if they're not able to use that and wield that as the cudgel that they want to, then what do they have exactly? Right?
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the really interesting thing that's going to be coming out of this.
Interesting. How, you know, it could backfire, actually. It depends on, you know, how, I suppose, how successful these guys are. I mean, I know with any campaign, you know, these consultants like to, when they're fishing for new candidates, they like to point to their previous success, obviously. And, you know, if these 14 groups can do that, boy, that could hurt the DCCC. The Democrat, you know, the establishment of the Democratic Party just amazes me. And I would, how self-destructive they can be. And I think it's important, you know, a lot of people, some people have done the Dem exit thing. They're leaving the party. They're angry at what happened in 2016. The DNC, the bureaucracy, is not the party. The party is the people, the millions of people who vote Democrat, who are active locally and at the state level. They basically hire the bureaucracy to work for them. And we need to keep that in mind. And it's hard to do sometimes. There's another group you mentioned, the Justice Democrats. I've been hearing more about that. What are they about?
Yeah, Justice Democrats, you know, are a member of the DCCC blacklist, launched by Cenk Uygur of Young Turks and Kocalinsky of Secular Talk back in, I think, about exactly a week before Inauguration Day 2017. You know, just kind of like a left-wing Democrat movement that kind of operates, I don't exactly want to say that they are 100% to the left, really, of of the CPC, of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. But you know, they're definitely putting themselves out there.
And these are members of Congress?
What's that?
These Justice Democrats are members of Congress or potential candidates, or
No, they're just a group. They're a pack. So they just endorse and work for progressive candidates.
Well, leaving.
But I guess what I meant was like that by being to the left of the CPC is that, or you know, whether or not they are or not, they're kind of like setting themselves up as kind of separate from that. Much as you might say that there could be a PAC, a PAC, that would be working kind of in concert with the DCCC's goals, but would be separate from them, maybe to their right or to their left, but would kind of be like working alongside of them, if that makes sense.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's interesting. And you know, we are getting into the weeds a little bit here, but we got to do that. And, you know, this stuff counts. It really matters. You know, people have to understand the system. Look, if we want to win, if we want to get Trump out of there, there's a lot of work to do, a lot of organizing and you know, dotting I's and crossing T's. It's got to be done. So the DCCC, the establishment Democrats, the people who, you know, the DNC admitted, they acknowledged that they rigged the primary process for Hillary last time. I would hope that they wouldn't do it again, seeing as to what happened. But who are the interests? What interests are being served by the establishment Democrats in the DCCC? And I mean, is it simply, you know, like Wall Street and corporate, or is it more than that, do you think?
Well, I don't know if I would completely agree that the DNC so much rigged the primary process for Hillary as much as I would just say that the process was set up so that she would win. And I know that seems like a minor distinction, but I think that there's something about the language of rigged that makes it sound like that Sanders ever had a chance. And that's just not true. He never had a chance. Like the way that it was set up, there was never any way that he would win. And so I think that I just want to push back on that just a little bit, because I think that that's a little bit inaccurate.
Okay, that's important to do.
What I would say is that this time, you could probably argue for it more if certain things happen. And I think the most important thing that people need to remember right now is that superdelegates get to vote in the second round.
Right.
Forward. So if you want your candidate to win and your candidate is a Democrat who is to the left of the party and that the party's establishment doesn't want to win, then you should probably do everything that you can to make sure he wins on the first ballot.
Yeah, for sure.
Because then the rigging kicks in, because that's when they go, that's when they're going to hit.
Yeah, that superdelegates thing is a real problem, in my opinion. But I wonder about, you know, like what interest the DCCC is serving. You know, if they're more moderate, and the whole left-right thing has changed dramatically over the years. What used to be the center in the 50s, what was called the Vital Center by Arthur Schlesinger, would be considered significant left these days. Are there particular industries or businesses or groups that the DCCC is serving? I mean, certainly the Republicans have their associations, you know, the oil industry, the polluters, they love the Republican Party and they invest in them. So who might it be for the DCCC, do you think?
I mean, I'm without a net on this. I'm not talking from any standpoint of knowing exactly, but I would say definitely healthcare interests. Definitely some energy interests similar to the Republicans. I mean, this, you know, the pushback on the Green New Deal from the Democratic Party, I think, is evidence of that. I think that the Democrats represent a lot of financial interests as well. And those are the interests that are not interested, if you'll pardon the repetition there, in paying more in taxes so that the things that they profess to care about will happen. You know?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, they can state it, but, you know, when it comes to the bottom of the line, you're right. I mean, you know, they may put on a, you know, slightly moderate face, but the energy interests and, you know, various different things that are doing all right now. So I wonder what interests the progressives aim to serve. You know, there has to be, you know, again, if they can't raise any money at all, they're not going to do it. So I wonder, I mean, obviously there's environmental, there's racial equality, issues like that. I wonder, you know, these new groups that are, you know, trying to form a different infrastructure from the more conservative DCCC, what interests might they be serving, do you think, or aim to serve?
Yeah, I think that the current American progressive movement, just from being an observer of it, is focused almost singularly on domestic policy. You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of, not that there isn't any, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of real push to reform kind of the more problematic parts of our foreign policy. But and I'm not saying that there's not an interest in that. I'm
right.
saying that, you know, you kind of have to decide what's prioritized, mm-hmm. and for better or for worse, they prioritize a lot of domestic issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say that Medicare for All is and Green New Deal are probably the two policies that, you know, you could kind of expect progressive Democrats to run on in 2020, whether at the state and congressional level or even president. It'll be interesting, you know, obviously in a presidential election year, normally, it's difficult to know what is going to become an issue.
Right. Yeah. For
if
sure.
If you add in the fact that the Republican candidate is chaotic, then you just don't really know. I would say that Trump is probably going to make immigration an issue, which means that, you know, Democrats need to get a message together, and I would argue it needs to be a better one than I've seen from most of them so far.
We agree on that. My goodness.
Yeah.
There was no message. Sorry to interrupt, but there was no message in 2016. Make America Great Again is a simple, clear message. My feeling, and this is just my opinion, is that Medicare for All, people get it, but you're right that, you know, there's certain interests who, frankly, don't want that. And they are within, definitely within the Democratic Party. Who is this Pramila Jayapal? Who is she and what is her role? And I'm not even sure if I pronounced it right.
Pramila Jayapal, I think, is, yeah, I think that is right. I think it's Jayapal.
Okay, different.
She is a Democratic representative from the state of Washington, and she is the head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Well, she's the co-chair with Wisconsin's Polkon. And she is the lead sponsor of the House Medicare for All bill. She is an outspoken progressive, and you know, and she's kind of one of these people who, and you know, from the outside looking in, but really seems to be a quite effective leader. Seems to have the support of her caucus,
nice.
and when she speaks and puts herself out there, people listen. You know, no matter what side they're on.
True.
So,
and when there are so many, when there are so many Democrats, which is a nice thing in my opinion, you know, a few people are going to stand out. I mean, they're some Democrats and Republicans, I suppose, for that matter, try to please all the people all the time, and you know, never want to upset the apple cart. That's one approach, you know, like say as little as possible and don't rock the boat. And there are centrists, you know, again, the centrists move pretty far to the right. Some centrists are worried that if the party looks too left-leaning, that's a big risk to winning in 2020. No doubt the DCCC is thinking that. What might be the arguments as to why the party needs to either be less diverse or more diverse? Any thoughts on that, Owen?
Well, I think that, I mean, as far as like moving to the left, polling regularly shows that the more left-wing positions are actually quite popular for the American people in general. You know, whether they're right, center, left, identifying, however. So I think that, you know, I understand you're not making that argument, but I think that argument that people on the right wing of the Democratic Party make is just is self-serving, but it's not really based on, it's maybe based in bad messaging as far as how you get that stuff across, but it's not based in the actual policies, which are almost always quite popular.
Yeah.
You just have to learn how to phrase the question correctly.
No, absolutely.
Or you know, yeah, no, I know you know that. I'm kind of talking.
Oh, it's true.
Talking to them a little bit there.
I
guess that the argument that people on the right wing of the party would say is that, you know, we need to reach out to conservative white voters in the Midwest, the ones that gave the election to Trump.
Yes.
And, you know, they care about immigration and the economy and they're, you know, I mean, like there's this implicit but unspoken thing that what people are saying is that we need to get white men back.
Right.
And, you know, well, first of all, I'm sorry, guys, like that ship has sailed. That's not coming back. but second of all, the way that you're approaching this is not the priority. Like you're not using the right priorities to get these voters back anyway.
Mm.
And then, of course, I mean, I could kind of go on and on about this, but I guess I would just also conclude by saying that it's quite possible as well, another kind of pushback on that maybe it wasn't the message that lost those voters in 2016. It was just not going there. And showing them that you actually cared, whether or not, you know, your message was good or bad, you just weren't there. And the progressives would argue that, you know, kind of what I just argued earlier, that, you know, these policies are broadly popular and the party should embrace them and that, you know, it's just really about how you deliver that message.
Boy, I do think you're right. I mean, there's so many who are like, you know, kind of afraid of their own shadow. They don't want to risk alienating anybody. And I think you're spot on there that
Right.
And people are worried about the Midwest. And, you know, the Midwest used to be kind of a hotbed of populism, left-leaning populism, like 100 years ago. It's not that anymore. But how do you reach them? And when the campaign blatantly saw that area as a flyover, the heck they're going to, you know, come on. You have to show them that it's in their interest. Now, what if you just tune in.
Actually,
go ahead.
Can I just add something?
No, please do, yes.
Yeah. I just want to, like, and kind of like going back to like what we were talking about, the primary system back in 2016, and talking about like the popularity of progressive messages. You know, let's not forget that in 2016, when Bernie Sanders entered the race, he had zero expectation and was really not running to win. You know, he just wanted to kind of force the conversation to the left. The fact that he came as close as he came without really trying until, I would argue probably like, you know, until like maybe December of 2015 kind of seemed like when he was like, oh, well, what, you know, I can actually do this.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that that shows that that's a popular message. Because if you're going in, you know, I mean, because I'm sure you remember him announcing in front of, you know, under a kind of makeshift tent in Vermont,
yes,
with like maybe 30 people there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was July 2015. Then, you know, then jump forward to, you know, the end of the year, and he's drawing these huge crowds. I think that shows right there that the message is out there.
I think so, too. Now, there have been a lot of reports lately. I mean, the New York Times had an article saying that social media posts are not representative, that they're more liberal than the majority of Democrats. And they talk about so-called pragmatism, and that maybe there may be something to this. That, I mean, on social media, yeah, obviously left-leaning, but the article in the New York Times ends with this quote, and I wonder how you respond to this. It would be a mistake to assume that more moderate Democrats are out of step with the party's electorate. Your thoughts on that? Are there more moderate groups out of step with the party's voters?
Yeah, so let me start with just a general response to that article, which is that for over 2 years, the New York Times and other mainstream media organizations have been shrieking about a few Facebook posts by Russian troll farms as being the thing that swung the election. And now they're trying to tell us now that the social media landscape is tilting to the left. Now they're trying to tell us that that doesn't matter anymore. I think that's quite convenient. In general, I would say that, although I don't know what the methodology of the polling that they used is, there is kind of a divide in the country as far as people who they poll online and via text, and then people who they poll kind of traditionally. And the traditional polling method is to call people on landlines. And increasingly, Americans, especially young Americans, are not using landlines. So, of course, and I'm not 100% saying that was the methodology used here, but if it is, then you're not getting a representative slice of America at all, because all you're doing is you're just talking to people who are older, who tend to skew more to the right.
Mm-hmm.
And while they do vote in larger numbers, percentage-wise, at least, of the younger population, it's still not particularly representative. If you want to look at any social media echo chamber, or even look at the you know, the fifth of the American population that's on Twitter or something, yes, you're going to see people who have more reliable internet connections, people who have access to technology, people who are younger and have grown up with it, and people who are more educated. Yes, that's true. Does that mean that that group of people is less representative of Americans as a whole than the people who you're cold calling at their home on their landline?
Right.
I'm not sure.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't think that it's something that you can just jump to this huge conclusion about. Although, I mean, that's kind of, I guess, what they do.
That is what they do. If you just tuned in, I'm Bert Cohen, and the show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Owen Higgins, senior editor at Common Dreams, and we're talking about his article, A Network of Alternative Campaign Infrastructure, Progressive Democrats Dismiss DCCC Threats on Primary Challenges. And, you know, I think all this comes back to identity. You know, the more moderate, skittish Democrats say, oh, we don't want to alienate anybody. You know, if you take too strong a stand, if you're too left-leaning, you push people away. I mean, quite frankly, I wish Bernie had been saying economic democracy rather than that S word. However, that's what he's doing. I think economic democracy doesn't scare people as much. But it's a question of identity. It's, you know, if people know Trump is Republican, that is the Republican Party. Donald Trump is the Republican Party. But who the heck are the Democrats? I just think, you know, without a clear identity, we're gonna lose again. I don't know, but I, you know, if you got to hoist something up the flagpole to see if people salute it, that's just my feeling again as an old Democrat here. Now, there's a couple of people that you mentioned who are doing some interesting work. Your article mentions the work of Rebecca Katz. Who is she, and what is her angle in all this?
Yeah, so Rebecca Katz is, she's one of the people in these, she's a member of these 14 progressive groups. She's the founder of New Deal Strategies. You know, they're just like a strategic consulting firm. But she definitely came out and made a very strong statement on, you know, once the DCCC blacklist group kind of made their announcement. I'll just read her whole quote because I think it's really good. As a loyal Democrat and progressive, I believe that we don't just need more Democrats in Congress. We also need better Democrats in Congress. I won't hesitate to work with progressive candidates challenging incumbent Democrats who are out of touch with their constituents. If that means getting blacklisted by the DCCC, then so be it. And you know, as I said earlier, I do really think that's indicative of the way that this may backfire on the DCCC, in that they were like, okay, we'll try and force you to choose incumbents and kind of like look for your pocketbook over, looking to your ideals. But what it seems like is happening here is that people are saying, well, actually, no, what we're going to do is we're just going to create our own separate party apparatus, and now you have no control. You have no control over the money that we're going to bring in, and there's really not a lot you can do. And that seems like it's a pretty big backfire.
And I have wondered. I mean, people have been talking about, just leaving the Democratic Party and going to some notion of something called the Green Party, which there isn't. I mean, a party is an infrastructure. It's a lot of data banks. It's, you know, a huge, crucial infrastructure. And I think what you're describing here sounds, you know, it's within the Democratic Party. And, you know, the DNC, the top of the party, is going to be the last to get it. The party really is at the ground level. And I'd like to think that there's some hope for this, because this is what people care about. You know, there's a couple of different constituencies within the Democratic Party. One is young people, and there's a lot of them. And generally, historically, they haven't voted very much, but I believe they did in 2018, and I believe they're a significant factor in this. So let's address that. And then the old base that kind of the party turned its back on is working people. And a lot of working people a lot of them are kind of socially conservative. And, you know, they're concerned about focusing so much on abortion and gay rights and stuff like that. A couple of big questions there. What do you think about those two constituencies and how we can best bring them in?
Well, I think the Democrats need to definitely develop a message that works. A message that is, you know, earlier you were saying that, you know, make America great again. I'm kind of putting words in your mouth, but I think that this is what you meant, and I agree with it, that it was kind of a great slogan in that it's very simple.
Yes.
and it's and it appeals like, you know, like
it's got to be simple.
You know, we can we're not talking about like what it means. We're talking, you know, right?
Right. No,
we're
just saying,
look, this is a great slogan as far as politicking goes.
Yes.
And I think that the Democrats probably need something pretty simple like that.
Yeah.
As far as getting young people out to vote, I mean, I think that people, I think that these politicians need to start talking to their interests. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think that it's a mistake. I don't think that it's a coincidence that Sanders in 2016 said, yeah, we should like annihilate student debt and have free college. And like he had a bunch of young people voting for him.
Yeah. What a surprise.
But I don't think those two things are unrelated.
Right.
You know? Like,
and they do tend more progressive. There's a lot of young people.
They do, yeah.
But what do you think about, you know, people, again, in the Midwest who, you know, working people who the Democratic Party has always stood up for working people, for unions and stuff like that. But, you know, on the social issues, the LGBT, I just, you know, I hope we can still keep those people and keep on that. And hopefully one doesn't put off the other. I guess maybe as I'm hearing myself talk, a message like Medicare for All, I would think working class people would get it, that they pay way too much. And, you know, if you got to bring medical care into the Midwest, where there are very, very few hospitals and doctors, and Medicare for All can do that.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
This is anecdotal, but, you know, as somebody who was a member of, and I mean, still is, but was definitely a member of the service and construction working class for decades, you know, all over New England, in the Midwest, on the West Coast, and in the South, I think that the people who are part of the working class that can be reached by Democrats that are so focused on social issues that they vote on it at all is a small and continually dwindling number. And
interesting,
the amount of those people that can be reached by anybody other than the Republican Party is not really even.
That's true. Yeah, it's not growing
now. Too from a political point of view, I'm not saying.
Yeah.
From ideologically, they're not worth reaching out. I'm saying like if you're talking about like winning an election, they're kind of like the game's over with them. Kristen Wright is going to vote on racism first, and then abortion and gay rights after that.
That's true.
That's just what it is.
That's what it is.
Evangelicals, that's what it's based on.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you're not going to win those people.
Right.
So, but as far as like the general working class in America, I mean, Trump voters were richer than Clinton voters. The working class went to Clinton. I mean, like they're not.
They did. It's true. Like,
they're still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did. They not by as much as they should have, but people, poorer people and working class people voted for Clinton more than they voted for Trump.
Of course.
So
what about the danger that people, you know, talk about purity, you know, that some people say, oh man, you know, and I agree that purity is poison. You're not going to get everything you want. It just doesn't work. What do you think? Is there a serious danger of purists undermining the party establishment and thus enabling the Trump people to win? What about that threat? Because I hear that argument.
Yes, I do think that there are purists who are undermining the party and trying to help Trump win. And I think that those purists are the people who are fighting back against progressive principles. There are, if you look at the two wings in general, progressives versus the right wing of the Democratic Party, only one wing is ever expected to give anything up. And that's always the left.
Always.
And it's always made explicitly clear that the ones on the left are the ones that have to come over to the right. And so I do think that there are purists. But again, I don't think that they're on the left. I think that they're on the, you know, they're on the right. They're the ones that are continually making it clear that the members of the party need to adhere to their vision, and that vision is the priority, and maybe the other members of the party can get some scraps, maybe.
Yeah.
I would also say that vision of politics, that kind of center-right, maybe like slightly socially liberal, fiscally conservative, you know, even by the standards of the Democratic Party, which I think is pretty much all terrible on this, with maybe the exception of Ilhan Omar, but pro-war.
Yeah.
But even that is not good enough for them. Basically, Howard Schultz is the epitome of what they are. Where they're like, if you, I would like, essentially, as I see it, their political project is vote Democrat unless my taxes go up, and then I'd rather have Trump.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting part of reality. I mean, it's very complicated. One last thing, you know, I wonder about.
Oh, sorry. I just want to add one thing to that.
Oh, please do.
One of the reasons that I feel so strongly about that is because more Sanders voters stayed with the party and voted with Clinton.
Yes.
Than Clinton voters stayed with the party and voted for Obama in 2008.
That's right.
And so the people who are usually complaining about purity politics are the same people that did both of those, or the same people that did that in 2008, or at least their ideological heirs. And so I find it insulting to progressive Democrats, although, I mean, I will admit I don't have a party affiliation, but I think that it's insulting to progressive Democrats for Democrats who are on the center or the right to treat that wing of the party as if they're the problem and they're the ones that are not going to ultimately support the whoever the Democrats nominate. I think that it's insulting and wrong.
And we'll end on that note. If people want to read more of your stuff, commondreams.org is the place to go. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you so much. Very interesting and informative. And certainly, the Democratic Party is at a crossroads.